It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Back with another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast, brought to you by Fox News. You can check out all of our podcasts at foxnewspodcasts.com. I hope that you will rate, review, and subscribe to this one, and recommend it to your friends if you like it. Today, my guest is Dave Rubin. He's the author of a new book, Don't Burn This Country. He is an author, commentator, someone who's established himself as a pundit focused on the fusionist possibilities of conservatism and liberalism. As a former liberal himself, he's someone who really comes at conservatism with a lot of interesting views and is particularly invested in the idea that we need to be able to work through our differences together as a country in order to move forward together. This is a conversation that I think is going to be enlightening for a lot of people. He has been someone who is traveling around the country currently on a book tour that involves a lot of different people from a lot of different walks of conservative life, interviewing him on stage about his views and about his book. And I hope that you will give it a listen. Dave Rubin, coming up next.
Kudlow on Fox Business is now on the go for podcast fans. Get key interviews with the biggest business newsmakers of the day. The Kudlow podcast will be available on the go after the show every weekday at foxbusinesspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
Dave Rubin, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
Ben, it's my pleasure. I feel we have much to catch up on in this crazy world.
Yes, we certainly do. Don't Burn This Country is an injection of your normal combination of seriousness and optimism in terms of looking at the way that things are and hoping for the way that they can be. I wonder, though, if you feel a bit more pressure this time around in terms of making that argument in a moment in which everyone seems to be losing their minds.
It's an excellent first question because, you know, the funny thing is when I wrote Don't Burn This Book a couple of years ago, it came out 2 years ago this month, actually. It was right at the beginning of lockdown. And when I wrote that book, and really, you know, it takes some time to write a book, as you know, so that for the year before when I was writing it, it was sort of, oh, let me just tell my story. A lot of people kind of know my story. I'll introduce some people to that story, but really lay out the beliefs that I have, why I believe these things, et cetera, et cetera. And then the book comes out. I was supposed to go on a book tour. That gets blown up. The world obviously shuts down and is very different than it was just 2 years ago. And the things that I was warning about in that first book, the ideas of collectivism, of wokeism, of socialism, et cetera, et cetera, those things have continued to march. So it's not as if the ideas that I laid out in the book were wrong, but just not enough people know them. I really believe that. And it's not obviously that these were all things that originally came from me. There have been great thinkers for hundreds and hundreds, thousands actually of years that have been pushing for the idea of the individual and of limited government and all of these things. This book really is okay, we didn't solve it. We didn't solve wokeism. We acknowledged it over the last couple of years, but now it's completely out of control. Everyone sees it. Boys or girls, girls or boys, 2 + 2 = 5. Being non-racist means you're racist. The rest of the backwards insanity that we're dealing with every day. So this book is sort of, okay, it is what it is. It's here. It's on our doorsteps. We've basically let it into the house at this point. What can you do in your life to live a better life? And as I say in the subtitle, so that you cannot really just survive, because we're all just surviving right now. But what can you do? What can you do to thrive in a time like this? And in some ways, Ben, I would say you and Megan are good examples of it because, you know, you guys uprooted where you live to live in a different place because you wanted to find a place that was more in line with what you do. You expanded your family, had a beautiful baby, and you're doing work that gives you value. That's very much in line with the ways that I think we can fix this thing, because it ain't the government that's going to come save us.
The wolf that you were talking about in the last book, though, that wolf that represents this toxic combination of collectivism, of viewing people through the lens of race and of a woke agenda, of talking about the redefinition of men and women and the like. If you were before the prophet warning the people, warning the townsfolk, the wolf is coming. The wolf is in the room now.
Oh yeah.
and there are a lot of people who are awake to the fact that the wolf is in the room, but they don't really know what to do about it. And you touch on at various aspects of this book, what they can do about it themselves. But what do you say to the person who comes up to you? And I'm sure as you embark on this nationwide book tour, you're going to have many people ask this question every stop that you're at. They're going to ask some question that comes from a feeling of hopelessness. Mm-hmm. You know, we might change our school board or change our immediate government, but the forces that are arrayed against us seem to be Goliaths. They seem to be systems with unelected bureaucrats and unresponsive authorities and people who, even if we push back against them in little ways, feel like they still have the right to direct what your children are learning and redefine, you know, everything under the sun according to their whims. What do you say to the hopeless person who comes and asks you that question?
Well, first off, I would say, well, you know what? You're right. They are Goliaths. And there's a story. It's an old story about this guy, David, and he beat Goliath. And my name's Dave. So I think we got a chance here to beat Google, the Goliath of our time. Look, you have to give the devil his due. The woke, for as ridiculous as they are, and for as much as we may make fun of them, and for as bad as their ideas have wrought an extraordinary amount of destruction across Western societies. I mean, every single institution that we have in the United States right now that we thought would just be an institution forever, they're all crumbling right now, whether it's cultural institutions, whether it's corporate institutions like Disney, whether it is our educational institutions, that's obviously happening all over the country, whether it's our medical institutions, the CDC, the NIH, et cetera, everything is collapsing under the idea of wokeism. So the first part of the question to answer it immediately is, hey, sit there for a moment and acknowledge that these guys really did do this, because that means that you're dealing with something that really is dangerous. And it's not just completely, it's not by luck that they did all this. It's by design that they did all this. And you can read some of their own literature to figure that out. The second part is, within that is our strength, because, you know, giant corporate institutions or giant educational institutions or whatever they might be, giant institutions as a general rule will eventually fail through the weight of their own volition. And let's take big tech as a good example of this. Big tech, nobody could have ever imagined that these giant companies could ever exist with such ubiquitous power that they would be bigger than the United States government. And that's in effect what they are. The founders talked about government overreach because they couldn't have fathomed that these things could have existed. But it's not really about the government. They were talking about big things in essence. So over time, as these corporations, say Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, et cetera, as they've gone woke and they're all going woke in their own ways, they no longer hire the best people. So if they're hiring at, say, Twitter and they have a diversity, equity, and inclusion department, you know, an HR department that has gone woke, basically, where they say, we're not going to hire the best engineers. We're actually going to hire the engineers based on their skin color or their sexuality or their gender identity or whatever it might be. Over time, by not hiring the best engineers, you will no longer build the best product, and somebody else will build the best product, a better product than they're offering. So I think it's partly entropy. It's knowing what the issue is. Okay, that's one thing. Then it's allow the entropy to happen that will cause these things to crumble. But then the third key part of it is, yes, are they big? Yeah. Are they scary? Sure. But go build other things. And I know this is where, Ben, we have a lot of similar friends and we run in a lot of the same circles. This is where, you know, a lot of the libertarians will get hit because it's like, oh, go build it yourself. And rarely do people build things. But you know what? There are people building things. As you know, I started locals in the midst of all of this over these last couple of years to replace Patreon. And we're doing a heck of a job with that. And then we merged with Rumble, which in essence is not only a YouTube replacement, but also an Amazon AWS replacement. And that's just one version of this. There are people building new businesses right now. There's people all over the country that are moving to new cities because they're going, man, I can't run a business anymore in woke Los Angeles. So let me move to free Florida and go to the hub of the world right now, Miami, and do something awesome. So you have a lot of power. You just have to recognize it.
Let's talk for a moment about that tech side of things, because I think people probably are aware of it, but may not, if they're not a creator themselves, have fully grasped what's going on there. You write in your book about the experience of leaving Patreon and that it was a significant financial hit for you. Mm-hmm. You also have this platform yourself that you mentioned, Locals. Tell people a little bit about the dynamics at play there, and also maybe share a little bit about what this looks like in terms of the new media economy and the way that people are charting their own paths in a moment that has really resulted in some surprising differences in coverage. I don't know if you noticed this tweet from Chris Albin the other day. I don't know Chris, but I thought it was rather amusing. He had a tweet along the lines of, you know, today's media is like freelancer, $35,000 a year. I self-financed a trip to a war zone in order to learn the stories of the people most affected by it. Columnist, $300,000 a year. Here's why China's foreign policy is like an egg roll. And I really do believe that's the kind of the circumstance that we're living in now, thanks to some of these technological platforms that haven't existed until recently, but they also have, you know, some other risks at play there. So maybe walk us through that.
Yeah, sure. So I'll hit the tech part first, then the media part second. You know, on the tech side, I go into this a bit in the book, but very quickly, the reason that I left Patreon, and for those people that are listening that don't know what Patreon is, it was basically the first crowdfunding platform that became really well known online. So if you were a YouTube creator or a musician or an unboxer or whatever it might be, if you got some people that want to subscribe to you monthly for however much you want to charge them, they basically became the middleman in that. And they were basically doing the payment processing on that. And the reason that I eventually left Patreon, I was sort of the first guy in the political world that went on there to fund my show when I wanted to go independent. The reason I got off was they made a few really, really terrible decisions. It was their own right to do what they want as a private company, but really made some awful decisions related to censoring some of the people on their platform. And in the case that I go into in the book, they actually censored a guy, a British YouTuber who goes by the name of Sargon of Akkad. They censored him for a word that he said, not on Patreon and not on the YouTube channel that he funded on Patreon, but on somebody else's channel. He happened to say the N-word, but he did not say it to be racist. He was making fun of the people that say the word. But without any recourse, without any warning, they decided to blow up his channel. And that's where he was making the bulk of his living. I think the guy has a couple kids. And I just felt that was a bridge too far. It was too risky to keep my business, which I was making about 80% of my rev, and I have several employees and everything else. It was too risky to be associated with a company that not could just kick me off because of something I said on the platform itself, but literally something I said somewhere else altogether that had nothing to do with them. That really was the beginning of why I created Locals. And then eventually we joined forces with Rumble because I felt, you know, if we're in a war, I mean, we actually are in an information war. And when you're in a war, you need some allies, right? Frodo didn't go back and throw the ring in the mountain with nobody with him. The whole point was that he had a couple guys with him. So that's why we've merged there. And I think we really are building some of the alternate rails. But to your point on the media, which I think is an interesting one that gets to the heart of that tweet, you know, it's funny. The supposed trusted media organizations, say CNN, Washington Post, New York Times, et cetera, they have become so patently ridiculous and so obvious in their incessant and unending lies that they've created a lane for guys like us, right? I mean, the truth is, when I do my show every day, I have no shortage of funny, ridiculous, depressing, whatever way you want to look at it, clips of people on these channels or writers at these places of quote unquote journalism flat out lying or making up stories, or the other type of fake news, which I find to be the most interesting one, the fake news of the things that they will not cover. So whether it is Brett Kavanaugh's a serial rapist, or that the Covington kids are racist, or that Kyle Rittenhouse is a racist, or that Donald Trump said very fine people on both sides and didn't condemn neo-Nazis, or the litany of other things that they do, while at the same time running cover for Joe Biden all the time and the Hunter Biden laptop story and why Twitter wouldn't put it up, and you couldn't even privately message New York Post links. And the New York Post, which has been a place of journalism for 200 years, you could not even link to it privately within Twitter. They've become so obviously ridiculous that it's created an avenue for people to come out and have some alternative opinions. To your point, though, there is a risk in that, because I do the best. I don't consider myself a journalist. I analyze the news. I try to do it with a little bit of sense of humor and stuff like that. But I'm not a journalist out on the ground doing those things. I'm basically translating some of the lunacy of the day to a palatable way for people to watch so that they can be somewhat informed and go about their day. CNN, I mean, these people are propagandists at this point. But if we all go off into our own little avenues of truth, we could end up even more frayed than we are. I just don't see an alternative to that right now. There really is no alternative to that. So we are in a bit of an uneasy situation right now, because the institutions have failed us, and we're throwing it on, as you said, kids that are crowdfunding to go to Ukraine. And we're in essence getting more truth from them than the people that were supposedly the trusted people at the New York Times writing the op-eds that were supposed to make sense to us.
Mm-hmm. There's a strain, as you mentioned before, of people who say, well, go and build your own thing. But the experience of people who've tried to build their own thing has inevitably run into significant challenges because of the way that America's internet infrastructure works, and because so much of what is created is based on web services platforms and the like that come from Amazon, that can buckle under pressure when it's brought to bear. Right now, for instance, we see a plethora of controversial or contrarian Substack newsletters, many of which are sustaining not just one, but multiple journalists and authors, and are basically creating these little internet fiefdoms for people who don't have the capacity to perhaps hire a designer or build the infrastructure necessary in order to send something out to thousands and thousands of people. But when given a platform like that, are making great use of it. The current authorities at Substack are clearly willing to go down this road and to support those who are there in a way that the folks at Patreon are not. But what happens in a situation where they get bought out or the leadership changes? Aren't we in a circumstance now where, you know, when you flip the switch, as we saw this past week with Elon Musk becoming the largest investor in Twitter and suddenly added to the board there, and suddenly people are talking about having all these things change about the way that the platform works, that seems to be a solution that depends on a lot of people with significant amounts of money being willing to go in and trying to change significant corporate infrastructures in ways that they may not particularly like. That seems to me to not be a holistic solution. It's something that's kind of a Band-Aid over the problem, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, you're hitting a lot of things there. So first, I would say, I don't know that there's a totally holistic solution to this. I think that there's a lot of different ways to skin a cat. So, you know, my general position on these things is that I don't want government involvement generally. I don't think that you take the biggest problem and then you ask the biggest problem to solve a whole bunch of other problems, because they usually just make things worse. That's not to say that there's absolutely nothing the government could do. Perhaps at the very least, break up the companies a little bit, so you'd break up Amazon's marketplace from its web services. Possibly. I'm actually not calling for that, but I could see some argument for that. And I've heard some good people make those good arguments. I mean, Tucker makes that argument constantly. David Sachs makes that argument, a few other people. It's not really the place that I like to make an argument from, because I like the idea of just building a better mousetrap. Now, To your point on the Amazon AWS part of this, that is the basic underbelly of the internet. That is when, after January 6th, Parler had 23 million users. It was exploding. It was the first new platform in a long time that was really scaling up. And basically, Amazon pressed a button or pulled a lever or touched a touchscreen. I don't know what they have over there. And they blew it up in one shot. And, you know, it's funny. I actually had written this in the book, and then I think I took out a portion of it. But we had some talks when I was running Locals. We had some talks with the Parler people, and I felt that they were not taking the threat seriously enough. So this was before January 6th, obviously. But I kept saying to them, you know, you have to be worried about the ability that big tech has to just knock any of us out at any given moment. And they didn't take it seriously enough. And look what happened to them. What happened really, though, was a mafia move. Because as you know, more of the coordination for January 6th took place on Facebook than on Parler. So if this was really about whatever happened on January 6th, and that's a whole other topic, the powers that be would have blown up Facebook, not Parler. But the point is that you must build other infrastructure. So that actually is why we merged with Rumble. Rumble is building that infrastructure, and much of it exists, believe it or not, to be that Amazon replacement. So that's what I'm talking about when I say the sort of second rails, the side rails of the internet. But that being said, Ben, and this is your point, I think that's only one piece of it, because then you have the payment processor piece. So Stripe is usually the payment processor that most of these sites use. Stripe, mm-hmm. I've met the guy who runs Stripe. He's a nice guy, but is he going to absolutely be willing to stand up fully for free speech all the time? I don't know. And you make the good point of Substack. It's like Substack is running sort of under the radar right now because they're not huge yet. It's a very niche thing. But as they get bigger and bigger, and it looks like they will, they're going to get hit by the mob and more pressure. And will their employees turn on them and the rest of it? I would say partly that depends on how woke they go. If they don't go woke in their corporate structure and they don't bring in a diversity, equity, inclusion office, and they actually stand up for free speech, they should be okay. But that isn't to say they will be okay, because some of it can just come down to an executive making a bad decision. So there's a lot of things that we got to watch out for here. But the build your own crowd, I think, although they don't often do it, and it's often glib when people say it, I think that really is the answer. Human evolution, human advancement is made by people who go out there and build new things. It was not easy to build the railroads across America, but people started doing it. I'm sure you know all the stories of Thomas Edison, basically fighting against and possibly stealing some of Nikola Tesla's stuff, 150 years ago. So these are things that just go and go. And while the powers that be seem stronger than ever, I suspect that perhaps they are not quite as strong as we think.
Mm-hmm. One aspect of this that I'm curious about from your perspective is, you made the move after being in California for a very long time to go to Florida to be at, as you said, the epicenter of freedom during this time. With that has come a renewed culture war event that has obviously captured the conversation nationally and received pushback from the left and from the White House and others for a piece of legislation that seems to me to be the kind of thing that most Americans could get behind until 5 minutes ago, which is an understanding that it's really not in the position of public educators to teach young children about sex or sexual orientation or anything really related to sex when they're at such a young age. That's something that I think Democrats, Republicans, and independents would largely agree about. And yet it has taken over the conversation and dominates it now to a degree that it really is requiring politicians across the country to give responses or to view new pieces of legislation that are potentially headed toward their desks. What are your thoughts having moved to Florida in this time during this uptick in the culture war over sex and gender related issues?
Well, first on the Florida front, I can do it in 10 seconds. This is the spear of the tip this is the tip of the spear, I should say, of freedom. It's all here. You can live freely as an American in Florida, the way that we all used to live. Put aside the no income tax. There is a spirit of freedom here that is absolutely incredible. And I am going to do everything I can as a Floridian to keep Florida, Florida. On this ridiculous, well, it's HB 1557 is the name of the bill, actually, but everyone's calling it Don't Say Gay because there's nothing that the media does better than parrot nonsensical talking points to make it seem like everyone's crazy who's not crazy and make it seem like everyone's sane who's not sane. As you pointed out, what this is about is indoctrinating young children into gender ideology. And all of us know, every sane person knows that this should not be happening. The bill is about kindergarten through third grade, that you should not talk to them about gender identity or sexuality or matters of sex. We all know this is to be true, but it's not even just that. It's also about transparency related to the family. So as it stands right now, what the bill is trying to do is say, hey, if you're a first grade teacher of a six-year-old child, you are not allowed to privately discuss sex or gender or sexuality with that child. And then on top of it, of course, you shouldn't be allowed to do that. But then on top of it, right now, you can keep that conversation private and not report it to the parents. It's absolutely psychotic. That has nothing to do with being anti-gay. You could just as easily call it Don't Say Straight, because you wouldn't want a straight teacher discussing sexuality. Would you want a straight male first grade teacher discussing sexuality with a six-year-old in first grade? Of course you wouldn't. So the media ran with this ridiculous meme of Don't Say Gay, and they all just repeat the same nonsense when, as I said, you could have just as easily called it Don't Say Straight. But this is really about a transparency and education bill. And at the end of the day, this is really, who is in charge of the kids? Is it the parent or the school? I mean, if you think it's the school, and if you think that it's the educators and state employees who are basically all activists, then you're really confused. And I would even go further than that. Even if they weren't activists, I grew up, and Ben, I'm guessing you had a somewhat similar upbringing. I went to public schools myself, but regardless of whether you went to public or private schools, my teachers were mostly, I don't know, women in there probably. I thought they were all very old at the time. In retrospect, they were probably in their 50s or 60s, so not that old. But the idea that my first grade teacher, Mrs. Siegel, who was teaching us, you know, basic 2 + 2 = 4, which back then it did, that she would then be able to talk to me about gender or sex as a first grader is completely, completely insane. And we all know it. And we just need to fight better. And you know what? If we can't fight better, then we need to defund the Department of Education. I would blow it up tomorrow. I would blow up the teachers union, and I would get your kids out of public school. And I know it's tough, but we need to be funding students instead of systems. And we need more charter schools. We need more pods. We need more home education. The big thing doesn't work anymore, which is consistent with everything else that we're talking about here.
There's a real, I think, tension within the right right now about what can be done to respond, though, to these significant steps that the left is taking within these institutions that they have really controlled either directly or indirectly for quite some time. There's, you know, controversy over, should we ban these types of discourse? Should we, you know, pretend that this is something that teachers won't still try to sneak into the classroom? What's your take on what would be meaningful steps that ought to be taken from a governing perspective beyond just the school choice answer, which, you know, obviously is something that I favor, a lot of people favor it, but is a pretty heavy lift within all of these different state systems, and doesn't necessarily have the type of faith within it that appeals to a lot of the people who are, you know, coming from more working class backgrounds and the like, who are planning to send their kids to public school anyway and just want them to perform better or to teach what they believe as opposed to what these woke teachers believe.
Sure. It's a great question. Look, I think you can make the argument that if you funded students instead of systems, that you could solve a lot of that, because then you'd have more choice, hopefully, to send your kid to a better school. But I get it that's sort of a pipe dream at the moment, although I think it will start happening more and more. In essence, what should happen is that every single state should have their own HB 1557. And you should fire every teacher who sneaks any of this in immediately. Fire the teacher, fire the department head, fire the vice principal, fire the principal, fire the superintendent, and fire all the way up. These people are not teachers. They are indoctrinators. It is irrelevant to a student's education. If you are a kindergarten teacher and you feel that you must tell your students about your relationship, regardless of whether it is heterosexual or homosexual, these people have nothing to do with education. They are brainwashers, much in line with the brainwashers of CNN and New York Times and everything else. So start getting serious. I'll tell you, related to this, I just saw Ron DeSantis speak at an event that I was emceeing at, actually, last week. And somebody came up to me after and was saying how incredible DeSantis was. And then he said, to his shock, I've heard him speak many times, so it wasn't shocking to me, but to his shock, he said, you know, all he said is common sense. All he said was common sense. We all know it. We all know it. We're all just afraid to say it. Well, you know what? Ron DeSantis is just one guy doing the right thing. Imagine if we had 10 more governors doing the right thing. And then next thing you know, you had 20 more governors doing the right thing. So don't think that, you know, the guy, the elderly gentleman pretending to be president is the end all be all. He is not. And this administration is coming apart at the seams. There are many other ways to fix things in your life. But it's not, at the end of the day, even a guy like Ron DeSantis and even the good ones, they're still not going to save you. You got to save yourself.
I know that you have been talking in front of audiences now for many years, and you make acknowledgement of that. Your work with Jordan Peterson and you know, the conversations that have come out of that have obviously been things that have grabbed the public consciousness in many different ways. And you've been doing this during a time when things seem to have gotten very ramped up, much more high octane in terms of the animosity that people on the left and right have for each other. This is, you know, very obviously not a good thing for, you know, our republic. It's not something that, you know, certainly leads to a healthy discourse. And yet I think a lot of people feel like they're trapped within it, and that the only way to proceed is to fight back, and to fight back harder. You saw this, of course, around the DeSantis bill, with right wingers starting to say, you know, okay, groomer, or things along those lines to people who were pushing back against it. And then the usual suspects denouncing them for being uncivil. To me, civility is not the primary aim that we ought to have. We ought to be aimed toward truth as opposed to civility. But is it even possible to have a civil discourse, a civil argument, when things that are as fundamental as can men become women are being, you know, are being dismissed by, you know, the most recent nominee, now Justice of the Supreme Court, who says, you know, I'm not a biologist, I can't answer that question.
Well, look, Ben, a non-biologist is now going to probably make a decision on Roe v. Wade and potentially and on potentially things related to trans issues and all sorts of other stuff. Potentially, you know, should the government be funding, you know, 12-year-olds getting sex changes? So these things are not disconnected. But I do agree with you. What you have to care about more is truth rather than civility. You know, when I started doing this show 7 or 8 years ago, at least in its, you know, form of longer form conversation, I was one of the first guys doing the long form thing online. Obviously, there were many legends before me that were doing that. Larry King, I would put at the top of that list. But I felt that civility was very important. I actually don't feel it's as important as I used to. I actually now, I feel that some level of separation and building new things is more important. They, as I said earlier, you got to give them credit. They have destroyed a lot. They have never shown signs of stopping. They have an awful lot of power and money behind them. And it is not to say you can't wake some of them up and deconvert them from their cult and all of that stuff. You can. But the better thing that you can do is use your time more wisely to build the society that you want to build. So the state that you live in is far more important right now, I think, in terms of your day-to-day life than the country. I love this country. I will always fight for this country. And I want this country to be more of the country that it was for most of my life. But right now, there is a chance in Florida. There's not much of a chance in California. Now, the real issue when it comes to that is if we sort of can agree that maybe there has to be some sort of separation. I'm not calling for a civil war or a secession, but that we should just stop
caring what's going on in other states as much, which is, of course, obviously that this is what federalism is all about. The issue is that the red states will gladly be left alone. Mm-hmm. Florida does not want anything from California, but California will want an awful lot from Florida, meaning Florida will continue to flourish and Cali will not let it flourish because Cali will keep blowing up its budgets, getting into debt, doing all sorts of stupid things. And the blue states will never leave the red states alone. That really is the issue. I don't know what the answer to that one is. Because if you really go down that path, then you've got everybody, you know, really building up their National Guard and all sorts of weird stuff. I don't think we're there yet, but I think we have to at least think about what this all means, that we are becoming polarized. And look, mm-hmm. you moved over the last couple of years. As I said earlier, you guys moved. We moved over the last couple of years. It was partly at least because of politics, because politics ultimately are the things that end up having your city burn or your street burn or your business get, mm-hmm. you know, destroyed. And then you go, okay, it's time to get out of Dodge.
So let's go out on this, Dave. You have this upcoming book tour where people can go to your Twitter feed and see all the different dates that you're going to be speaking in lots of different places. And you have interlocutors, including my wife, but also really representing a broad swath of people from a lot of different ideological perspectives. As you crisscross the country, I'm curious how... what your expectations are in terms of how different your experiences will be based on the places that you're speaking, whether that's something that's a factor in your mind at all, just given the patchwork of different policies that are in place, the big differences in terms of the way that downtowns of major cities now are less safe than they were pre-pandemic. You know, what are you expecting to see? What are you hoping to see? And do you think that this is going to be kind of a real experience that lays in front of you how different American experiences are based on where we live today?
Well, first off, let me take that ample opportunity to promote the show that I will be doing with the very lovely Meghan McCain, who you know quite well, which will be at the Miracle Theater in Washington, D.C. on April 25th. And people can get tickets at DaveRubin.com/events, and we'll do a meet and greet and all sorts of fun stuff. And I told Meghan she can absolutely do whatever she wants when she's on stage, and we're just going to have some fun. It's a great question, because as we talked about, since the country is so frayed right now, going to a city will feel very different than going to city A will feel very different than going to city B. We're doing a lot in Florida to start, and we're going to Texas, and I am doing that show with Meghan in the Swamp in DC, and I'm doing something in New York and a bunch in Cali and all over the place. But we didn't on this leg go to Portland. We didn't go to Minneapolis. We didn't go to Seattle. We didn't go to San Francisco. I didn't feel it was partly due to COVID restrictions, because I refused to perform anywhere that was going to have any restrictions whatsoever. So that did limit us in some ways. But it was also I kind of was like, I don't know if I want to deal with the headache of Portland to have Antifa show up and be screaming and just deal with the headache. And also, I don't know that there's enough sane people left in Portland, because they've lost a lot of the good ones, that we would, ensure a sellout and that kind of thing. So I suspect that It's going to be a lot of laughter. It's going to be a lot of fun. I think people have been trapped in their houses for 2 years. You know, when I get up there, I try, as Jordan did when we were on tour, I try to give a different talk every night. And, I'll use some blue language and say some off color stuff and throw some T-shirts into the crowd and just get people in a room having fun together again. So I'm not too worried about the haters. I'm not too worried about showing up in a city or two that maybe technically isn't, as friendly towards somebody like me, because people are people, and we're going to get some good people to show up, and we'll have some fun, and we'll see what happens.
Dave Rubin, author of Don't Burn This Country, Surviving and Thriving in Our Woke Dystopia. Thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
Ben, thanks for having me. Hope to see you soon.
More of the Ben Domenech podcast right after this. So I had the opportunity to be in Eagle Pass, Texas for a congressional delegation visit this week, one which was, as it turned out, timed to coincide with a terrible event that has attracted national headlines, one that certainly received a lot of attention on Fox, and which I'm sure that you're aware of, involving the tragic death of a National Guardsman who attempted to rescue two migrants who were trying to cross the Rio Grande River.
this was a sad occurrence. And as I rolled up into the park, what that was our meeting space this morning in Eagle Pass, I saw the gigantic line of Border Patrol SUVs and immediately knew that something must have happened. As it turned out, his body had been recovered from a nearby location. Look, this is a tragic situation, one that has become all too familiar in recent years as we have seen the situation on the border decay. I was there during the CODEL congressional delegation that included Kevin McCarthy, that included Elise Stefanik, included Chip Roy of Texas, and Marjorie Taylor Greene, among others. And I will just say to you that one of the things that really stuck out to me, having been around the border and having traversed it many times over the past couple of decades, is how much the language about the border and about border crossings has not been updated to be influenced by the reality of what we're seeing today. Far too many people are sounding the same notes that they did back in 2005, 2006, 2012, and the like, when you saw major spikes when it came to migrant workers attempting to cross the border, overwhelmingly from Mexico, overwhelmingly male, and typically people who would come into the country but then go back home when the season was up. We're not seeing that now. What we're seeing instead are these family units seeking asylum from other countries, countries other than Mexico, who are being funneled through Mexico by dint of cartel activity, who are trafficking in them, using them to funnel drugs like fentanyl into the country, using them to gain profit, and basically asking for every amount of money that they have down to the last dime in order to transport them and their children to America. This is something that's extremely tragic. It's a humanitarian crisis. It's horrible to watch. It's bloody. It has negative ramifications, not just for the people of these nations, but for our southern border. The fact that the cartels are better at controlling their side of the Rio Grande than we are at controlling ours is itself an indictment. But the point that I would make is that this decline is a choice. It is a policy choice that the Biden administration is making. They're making it time and time again every day. And when I see the likes of Jen Psaki, who has never been on the front line of anything in her entire life, who is just waiting for her MSNBC contract for her Peacock show to come due, say that this is a situation that the White House doesn't have to comment on because this was a Texas National Guardsman, as opposed to being someone who's assigned to the border by the White House, I'm disgusted. And I hope that Americans are disgusted, because this is a sign of a nation that is not taking its borders seriously. Look, regardless of your opinion about the levels of immigration that we ought to tolerate from the southern border or from anywhere else around the world, the simple fact is that we ought to be the nation that determines the control of our borders. They don't mean anything if we can't do that. And to see the kind of things that are going on there on a daily basis, on a regular basis, happen with impunity and with this attitude from the White House that all of this is fine and all of this is normal and everyone should just look away and pretend like that's the case, that disgusts me, and it should disgust every American who believes in national sovereignty. I'm Ben Domenech. You've been listening to another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast. We'll be back soon with more to dive back into the fray.
The Will Cain Show is now dropping 5 episodes a week. Join Fox and Friends weekend host Will Cain as he tackles the latest headlines from his unique perspective, along with thought-provoking interviews with leading figures and live calls from viewers and listeners. Listen wherever you download your favorite podcasts.